Welcome to Energy Medicine Radio with Dr. Wu Di and E-Love, a celebration of unique healing modalities for your mind, body, and soul, opening the pathway to wellness, enlightenment, and creative living. Our mission is to share consciousness-shifting information with humanity and help people improve and transform their overall quality of health, wealth, and happiness. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening. This is Dr. Wu Di in Miami Beach.
And I'm E-Love. Greetings, greetings. And we have a special guest tonight, Das, on with us. He's a multidimensional time traveler, a permanent pilgrim, and a conscious yogi from many previous lifetimes. And in this current incarnation, just visiting this planet, he is a composer of yoga meditation music since 1973 and a manufacturer of bamboo meditation flutes. He's also a performer and recording artist with 108 releases plus. I'm going to put the plus on the end because he's always working on things. Greetings and welcome to Energy Medicine Radio.
Greetings from Das in Northwest Florida, in the beautiful Gulf Coast, right on the ocean.
It's wonderful to have you on. Das, you have such a rich story behind how you got into yoga and meditation, and you've been to India. You've got lots of stories, so we want to hear some of those tonight, and thought we might start off with kind of an overview of the beginning of that journey before you went to India.
Beginning of that journey. Yes, this was the 70s and, you know, the post-Woodstock era. I was a little too young for the Woodstock generation. My older brother was there, so I was just a couple years behind. But in my town, I was raised in South Jersey, we had one yoga teacher, not even a studio. She was teaching in a rented room at the Holiday Inn. Nowadays, pretty much every town has probably got a half dozen, if not a dozen or more, yoga studios. But in 1973, actually, my mother saw this little ad in the paper. It said, yoga classes, you know, $5 or something like that. So she announced to me one day, guess what? I signed you and me up for yoga classes. And I was like, what? Yogurt? Dannon yogurt classes? What is she talking about? So anyway, we went, and we were the only two students. So that went on for months. And then I getting in touch with the ancient yoga practices. Now, not a whole lot of philosophy was spoken back then either. It was old school yoga, very old school, like that original guy who had the paperback in the 60s. I forget his name. It was like the only yoga book that you could find in a bookstore or the library. Nowadays you have hot yoga, Vikram yoga, this yoga, that yoga. Back then it was just hatha yoga. So that began my process of self-awakening or self-realization, you might say. Although, I've, like my hokey blurb says, I'm a conscious yogi for many lifetimes. So when I was a child, I was like communing with God and stuff like that instead of sleeping at night. I would sit in my bed and rock and feel the vastness of the eternal universe spreading out from the center of my brain, going out into infinity. You know, I had no words no vocabulary to say like I was communing with God or the Creator or the, you know, the universe or universe. You know, because I was 3 years old, no vocabulary. I couldn't even tell my parents what I was experiencing because to me it was normal to commune with the universe. Mm-hmm. So then, fast forward to where I started, the teenage years. So the yoga, I found that it started to break up like mountains of karma that was preventing me from knowing who I was and what I'm doing in the web of life. So that was a difficult process for, you know, the karma, the like mountains of it to fall away and the sludge and the roller coaster of feelings. But after I came out the other side, I realized that, wow, I have to stop eating meat, and I have to, you know, be a permanent pilgrim. So back then, vegetarianism, you know, I don't know what your listeners think about health and vegetarianism, but I became a vegetarian in 1973, not because of anyone else's propaganda. It was just something I knew I had to do for me. Mm. So back then, there was no ecological reason, compassion reasons, health reasons. You know, like nowadays, you have all this information. But back then, I knew I just have to do it for me. So with my mother's permission, I was 16 years old, I slowly reduced and see how I felt. And after a few months, I felt better. So, okay, drop it. So now I'm critter-free since 73. That might not be everyone's path, but it was very important to me, especially when I ended up going to India later. I found out all kinds of other stuff. So this same yoga awakening period, I was also composing music. I invented a term back then. I called it healing music. Nowadays, healing music is very popular. You've got everything from Stephen Halpern and all those guys to Mozart that they play in a hospital, you know, in the waiting rooms and stuff like that, so people are calm. So healing music is popular now. But in 1973, I thought I invented the term. Because, you know, we did have no internet and small town, South Jersey. I had no peers. So I invented this healing music. I was a keyboard player and a guitar player, so I started coming up with scales and chord changes that I felt were very pleasing and felt healing to me. And when I played it for other people, they would say, wow, that's really relaxing. But what is that you're playing? It's not rock, it's not blues, it's not pop. What is that? I said, I don't know. I'm just come up with this stuff in my bedroom. So the healing music journey went on for about till 1975, and then I realized I want to go deeper than American culture. So I started digging around bookstores, and I found Bhagavad Gita, the most popular ancient Hindu scripture, Mahatma Gandhi's favorite book. He would carry it around. You could see photos of him holding the book in his hand. And I found quotes. Albert Einstein thought it was a really cool book. Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson. So I thought, hey, I need to read this book. So I was doing my yoga in my bedroom every night and reading Bhagavad Gita. It was a really big, thick version, Bhagavad Gita as it is. And I thought, I'd never read a book this big in my life, but this winter, I'm going to do it. So doing yoga, and like I said, the karma falling away effect that I felt from the yoga. So then when my head was clear, I would read Bhagavad Gita for an hour in the evening. And to my great amazement, you know, because wearing thick glasses and being a bookworm type of dude, you know, I've read a lot of books. I used to check out books in the library, you know, as many as you can get at one time, in my search for knowledge and secrets of the ages. So Bhagavad Gita was like, wait a minute, this book is different. These smart guys that were saying good things about it, they're right. It's not like a book of information that I'm reading and learning. This book is like uncovering the ancient wisdom that's already inside of me.
It's a remembering.
That was the first book that really pushed me into remembering what I am as eternal spirit visiting the temporary human tabernacle. So after doing that for a while, I thought, I need to go deeper. American culture is just not happening. So I ended up living in different ashrams here and there for about 5 years. And then, I'm making a long story short here. And then I thought, I have to go even deeper. Because you're in the ashram in America, but right outside the door is America. Traffic jams, honking horns, materialistic culture, billboards full of decadent things. So I thought, I need to experience India. Because, you know, in my interfaith studies, I checked out all kinds of different things. I really enjoyed the writings of Pir Vilayat Khan, you know, the Sufi writings and all that, and other things, various world religions. But because India seemed to have a depth of well-preserved, not just knowledge, but culture, art, music, that were all connected for thousands of years, including Ayurveda. Dr. Wu, I'm sure, is very familiar with the ancient Ayurvedic tradition, which is very similar in some ways to TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. So I ended up going to India for 5 years and doing the whole pilgrim thing. Not like a tourist, you know, staying in hotels and having a big black camera for taking tourist photos and having big black sunglasses. I realized that, you know, I'm 25 years old. I said, this is my chance. I'm young. I'm fit. I have to do the sadhu thing. I have to be a complete spiritual pilgrim. I have to go all the way. So I ended up wandering barefoot and penniless all over India collecting ancient texts and learning languages so that I could access the secrets of the ages directly without reading anyone's translation. So now, 40 years later, I have
learned a lot of the old languages, a lot of like Sanskrit. Are you familiar? I know you're familiar with it, but did you learn that in India or study that?
Well, I started with the Sanskrit studies living in the ashrams in America for 5 years. But then when I got to India, you see, in the West, we learn Sanskrit not through the original script, the Devanagari script. We use Romanized letters, you know, A's, B's, and C's, like that.
Right.
So going to India, I learned the original script. That way I could pick up books that were not translated or transliterated. And so I learned Sanskrit and Bengali, Hindi, which is the national language, and Brij Bhasha, a very obscure dialect to the Vrindavan area, which is where Radha and Krishna played their wondrous sports about 5,000 years ago. So I learned these four languages over there so I could access the main and also the obscure scriptures that I was tirelessly looking for. I would see some reference to a very obscure book, and I would start looking under different rocks, and even rocks that nobody even knew was there, to try to find these old things. So now I have a fabulous library in five different languages.
Well stocked.
And I've translated about 40 of those into English, so that people who don't want to take the trouble to learn the language can, you know, read the English rendering. So my books are kind of all over the world. And the funny thing is, a lot of gurus, some of these gurus have thousands of disciples each. What they do is they have my full set subscription. So everything I publish, they automatically buy it. So then they read all this obscure stuff that it took me decades to dig up this rare stuff. And now these gurus read it, and they don't tell their disciples where they got it from. So they start lecturing on all these very, you know, interesting topics. And the disciples are like, wow, where does Guruji get all this information? So in a sense, that kind of makes me the guru of the gurus. or rather, just like the postman. I just supply the information, and then they use it, you know, for however they need to present themselves.
Right. Das, could you give us an example of, like, one of the teachings or something that would be buried in these ancient texts?
Yeah, well, we're focusing on this is a healing show. So one of my main experiences I wanted to tell you about in India is I learned one of the secrets of healing. And it might not be a secret. You'll resonate with it as soon as I get to the punchline. But I was captured in Vrindavan by a very well-known healer. He wasn't from India. He was from Nepal, named Shamasaki. He's passed on now. This is the mid-80s. Most of my friends were old people, and they're all dead now. So anyway, he captured me because, let's see, somebody told me, oh, yeah, this great healer. So I went over there to get a treatment. So he treated me, but then he shut the door. He wouldn't let me leave. So I thought, okay, this is interesting. He's capturing me. I'm under house arrest. So let's just ride this ride and see how it goes. So he would let me sit in the corner and watch him treat people. He would treat people all morning long, and then about noon, he would shut the door and bolt it from inside. In the old villages, you got this big plank that you put it, you know, inside the door in two little U-bolts or something. Put this big plank. So he would shut the door around noon, then about 4 in the afternoon he'd open again and treat a whole bunch of other people that would file in and out. So he would let me watch him for whatever reason. You know, he's a very, very well-known healer, so a constant stream of people. And what he would do to people, his treatments were very interesting. One person, he would make them sit on the floor straight up in the lotus posture, straight back. You know, just sit there for 5 minutes. So that'd be one treatment. Next person, he would lay them down on their back, and he would put his foot on their solar plexus and press. Then another person, he would make them turn around, and he had a big a big bundle of peacock feathers. You know, peacock feathers are about 3 feet long. He had this big bundle, and he would just give them a whack right on the butt. And because the feathers, you know, they have the hard stem, they make a loud noise, but it doesn't actually hurt. You know, it's not a beating. It's just an energy thing, or a boosh. So all these different weird things he would do to all these different people. So he captured me. I'm there for a few days, just hanging out, wondering why I'm captured. So I figured maybe he wants to teach me the secret of healing. He's very, very well respected. He heals a lot of people. He does all these weird things with people. Doesn't have any particular, you know, treatment. So,
like, no rhyme or reason.
Yeah. It's, the observer can't figure out what's going on. They would probably even think he's just some kind of a nut. But he was well known, and he gets results. So one day, you know, being a very forward person, and I'm in India to seek out the secret of the ages. So I buttonholed him one day. I said, "Okay, what's going on here? Tell me the secret of healing." He said, "Oh, you want to know the secret?" I said, "Yeah. What are you doing here? And you know, what's the whole trip?" He said, "I will tell you the secret of healing. It's Gudu. Gudu." I said, "Gudu?" He said, "Yes. The secret is Gudu." I said, "Gudu?" He says, "Yes, Gudu."
Gudu.
This went on for a little while because he was from Nepal. He's kind of like a little elf, you know. They have their nice round face and the way they tilt their head. He said, "Yes, Gudu." So finally I said, "What is Gudu?" So he reaches over to my cheek, gently pinches my cheek with his thumb and index finger, shakes it back and forth, going, "Gudu, Gudu, 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 Gudu." So you get it? Do you get it? The secret to healing, it's just energy exchange. It's just whatever. We market it as this and that and cranial sacral and massage therapy. And, you know, we have a million names for Gudu, but it's all just Gudu.
Not Gudu, it's Gudu.
It's just one living being who's feeling in tune, exchanging their energy with someone who's feeling out of tune. And
right.
It doesn't
matter.
And that's
what our whole show's about, is about how do we use that energy to heal each other?
Yeah. That can happen in a million different ways, depending on our own mentality and our own inclination and the stuff that we've learned on our own pilgrimage, the tools we've collected from others and the tools we've stumbled upon ourselves. But it's all Gudu. That's what it boils down to. It's all Gudu, Gudu, Gudu.
So is Gudu an actual word for energy in Hindi?
I've never looked it up, but because the way he did my cheek, that's what you do with the babies. You know, someone's
right.
Holding the baby, you reach over and Gudu, 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 Gudu. Whereas over here we say Gucci Goo, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
Or Goo Goo Gaga when you pinch the baby's cheek. But he called it Gudu. I never really did look it up to see, is it a dialect? Maybe it's a Nepali word, or it's Hindi, or... Never looked it up, but I guess I should if I'm going to be talking about it on radio shows.
Well, I think in India it's a name, too. A name that they name kids.
Really? Somebody will be named Gudu?
Yeah, and it's a Hindu name, but it's spelled G-U-D-D-U. And I can't find the meaning of it, though.
We have babynames.org and, you know, all those sites for baby names and Hindu names, too, and Arabic names. Just all those sites online for naming babies, and so they also have the ethnic varieties, too.
Right.
It might be
interesting.
There. But I didn't look it up because I just thought he meant the baby thing when you Gudu the cheeks, Gudu, Gudu, Gudu.
Yeah.
Now that might sound to some of our listeners who are spending lots of money and lots of time and effort learning so many different modalities. So I come along and tell my story about how simple, you know, the actual principle is. So I hope that doesn't upset anybody who's working real hard to get their certificates.
Well, underneath, the principle is energy. Healing is energy.
Yes.
So if they don't have guru and they're learning a technique, the technique without guru is not going to work the same way, correct?
Well, I don't know. It's been many years of studying and studying many, many techniques, and I find that I'm back at the technique that I first did, which is the energy.
Full circle.
Yeah, right. And, you know, I got a lot of plaques on the wall with a lot of doctorates and masters and all that stuff. But it brings me back to, it's the energy. And if my energy is strong enough and if I'm keeping myself in good shape, then I can project that energy and people get healed out of that. And sometimes it's in person. Sometimes it's over the phone. Sometimes it's over the radio. People listen, they open, and the healing happens. And that's a good word for it, guru. I love it.
Because at first
I thought you were saying guru, G-U-R-U.
Yeah, G-U-R-U, which is an interesting concept, because G-U-R-U. But no, this is guru, G-U-D-U, or maybe two Ds. Like Elof said, G-U-D-D-U. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder, because if the healing principle is so simple, we've made things so complicated with, like you said, doctor, so many certificates on the wall. Because, like, sometimes I see these ads, and we've got the Natural Awakenings magazine around here, and Horizons, and those kind of things. So I see these people with all these lists of certifications based on this, and they're Reiki Master number 3, and they're this, and they're that. And I'm thinking, well, gee, why didn't you just take one of those and master that and just use that? You went to get another certification, and then another, and another, and another, and now you just confirmed that by saying that you're doing the original thing again. Isn't that cool?
Right. Yeah, it's very cool, but sometimes, it's like if I started studying with you and you were teaching me flute, well, in the beginning, you'd say, okay, it's the whole right. And I'd say, well, I want to just play my music. But until I can play music, I can't play my. I don't even know what my music is yet. Sometimes you got to go through the steps.
Yeah, we do need some fundamentals to get some skills before we could start extrapolating and making our own slant or take on it.
Right, and right now, I know that he does sound healing and a lot of the techniques that I do involve sound, either, you know, with a tuning fork or chanting or something like that. And I'm wondering, how do you use the flute in the healing process or your music?
There's actually a great, I believe it's an Edgar Cayce quote, you can find it, where he says that the medicine of the future is going to be sound. So I really like that kind of quote. So what I do with music is, it's almost like the instruments are a front, where I don't always say that it's healing. In the right situation, I'll say this is healing music, and it has a lot of intention behind it. I'm sure you're all aware of power of intention. You could put something in there, and it'll be like Dr. Emoto's work with the water crystals. He's shown that how the intention of love or hate or appreciation or neglect, how that affects the water crystals. So with our music, and I'm sure Elof is totally on the same page, and we've actually played together healing music, maybe we'll release those recordings and film someday. So I use flutes and angelic harps that are specially tuned and kalimbas that are specially tuned and Tibetan bells that are in the same pitch. And I use a very harmonic variety of healing music. Some people do like the multiple bowls thing where they don't care what the tuning is, and you know that's cool. I like that effect too. But my approach is melodic, where I try to keep things in tune, and and it's free flow, and it's the intention is so deep with every note And actually, I hardly ever tell anybody this, but even though I'm known as a performer and I've been on so many stages, you know, in different continents and whatnot, I'm actually not a performer, quote unquote. You know, performers, like you see them on, well, you used to see them on MTV, you know, jumping around on the stage like a monkey, working the audience, making funny faces at the crowd, jerking around with the microphone. That's like a performing monkey to me. I'm not a performer. When I'm on stage, I'm in a total trance where I'm trying to transmit the highest healing intentions through cosmic sound to the audience. And I believe that what I'm doing, because I've been meditating since, like I said, since a toddler, what I'm trying to do is reach to the other side of the veil of illusion and tune into those energies that we don't see, but we see the effect of them. Like we see flowers blooming, we see seasons changing, we see storms and sun and rainbows. So the energy behind that is mathematical and fractal. So I try to tune into those energies, and my cute little poem is, I tune into the music of the spheres, and then I make it audible for human ears.
Nice.
So it's like being a trance medium. You know, people, you go to the trance medium and say, you know, Uncle Harry, you know, you died too soon. You know, what's going on the other side? And the trance medium says, Uncle Harry says. So I'm trying to be a medium between the unseen energies of the universe and bringing them into sound, which, like Casey said, sound is the medicine of the future. So all of my, quote, performances, unquote, and all of my CD releases and stuff are all geared towards the ultimate healing and ultimate good of the listener.
Well, nice. On that note, can we listen?
Oh, that would be good. So much talk about the music. Oh, why don't we hear some?
It would be great. We have one of your tracks called Rosy Orange Eastern Sunrise. Would you speak a little bit about that before we put it on?
Yeah, this is from my latest CD called Forest Music, which is a concept album. There's 12 songs. Each song represents 2 hours. So that it starts at sunrise, and it goes all the way through the day, and then it goes through sunset, and then it goes through midnight, and it goes through pre-dawn, and then I guess the cycle would begin over again. So this one here, this is the album opens. This is like the sunrise, the upward rising of the colors blooming, the day blooming, and the animals and critters and birds starting their day and, you know, flitting about and doing what they do. So that's how this is the beginning of the CD, where it's the opening.
And the instrumentation on this particular song?
Oh, this has various psychedelicized angel harps and kalimbas, flutes, panpipes, Tibetan bells, and bass flutes. The bass flute used on this one, it's about 5 feet long and about 3.5 inches in diameter.
It's probably about as tall as you,
Elove.
I'm 5'8".
Okay. It goes up to your neck then.
So we're going to listen to this track, which is Rosy Orange Eastern Sunrise. Let's give it a whirl.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Das, when you're making the music, tell us a little bit about that process, because the wording of the titles, the intricacies of the layering, there's more to it than just, you know, throwing it all together.
Yeah, well, I said that it gives me goosebumps because I'm not the performer. I'm actually the spectator, the listener, since, like I said, I'm channeling it. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, oh, listen to that cool riff I just played, everybody. What do you think of that? You know, the whole ego thing is, like, not there. So when I listen to it, it's like I'm listening to somebody else's music. Like, wow, that stuff is really cool. That's like the kind of music I always wanted to hear. So the compositional process, you'll notice immediately that it flows, that there's no verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, you know, fade out. At, you know, the pop structure of songs, I don't have anything to do with that. My songs are kind of like, you might call it a condensed energy bubble that's manifesting as sound. But the sound, now if this makes any sense, or we might stretch your brain a little, the sound is kind of like the smallest part of the music. It's like a film that rides along top of the energy which the music is sourced from. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, it feels like the flow of it is very organic and natural, and it feels, it sounds to me like listening to nature, like an aspect of nature.
Yeah, that's why it's called forest music, and the whole project is like that. I do have other CDs that have drums and rhythm, and I'm also an extreme electronica buff, so I've got groove boxes and wailing electric guitars that I play Indian ragas on, and But this project called Forest Music, all 12 songs, I was shooting for this one thing, where we cannot have worldly rhythms. You know, if you listen to the radio, everything's an eight. You know, boom, bat, boom, boom, bat, boom, blat, boom, boom, blat. So I was not doing that. I was trying to follow nature. Like when you hear the harp underneath, that's kind of like the ripples of the babbling brook or the ocean or a pond where the wind is blowing gently. You'll see the ripples. So that's the harp. And when the panpipes go, whoo, that's like a bird just flew by. And like that, all of the different elements I'm envisioning as being an aspect of nature. And that's why the music flows. It doesn't have verses and choruses like that. So this was a very focused project of 12 songs, a song cycle, like I said, begins at sunrise and goes all the way through to midnight and pre-dawn. And then it'll begin again. So it was a very, very focused project that actually, believe it or not, the entire album, I recorded all the tracks in 5 days.
Wow.
But then I spent almost 2 years fiddling with the tracks and moving the different parts out of each other's way to create the space that I felt represented what I was going for the free flow. So I spent more time deleting things than I did adding things. I laid down each day I would pick a session. All I would do was pick a family of instruments. Like, okay, here's a harp. Now what do I have in tune with this harp? Here's a panpipe in tune. Here's a Tibetan bell in tune. Here's a bass flute and an alto flute and a tenor flute and a soprano flute. So I would have these little families. So I would just choose which family would be for a song. And then I would just start recording parts without any concept of what was going to happen. So then I would
tuning
just add
in
more parts until I felt, okay, this song is like a room. It has enough parts to it. Okay, let's leave that aside, and now I'll pick another key, another family of instruments. So I have 12 different modalities on the album, and then, like I said, I spent quite some time moving everybody out of each other's way.
Did the music come first or the titles?
The concept of the nature scene. Like there's one about a still pond, and like this one was the sunrise. So the concept of the nature scene was there, but only after the music was completely done did I assemble each song title very specially formulated to have 4 words and 8 syllables. And it had to, in that format, it had to have as much of the scene present as possible.
To describe it.
Yeah.
Right. It was very melodic. It put me, you know, I was just drifting off with listening to the music.
Uh-oh, we're putting the radio host to sleep. It's a good kind of a trance.
Yeah, more of a trance, right?
When we do that live, it's going to be different for every gig. I don't have like a song list like these people that you see at the open mic night or traveling on tour. They've got their song list. You know, they play this song and that song. Every gig I do is completely different and kind of designed for that space and that crowd. So that's why I have a lot of live CDs, and they're all completely different. Because I don't have a set list. I have a concept. Because you know what? Ravi Shankar said this back in the 70s. He said, when I step on stage, I don't know what I'm going to play. I sit down in front of the audience, and then it just comes to me, and I start playing. So that always stuck with me. And I thought, wow, that's how you do it. You design the gig for that moment. You don't just show up with a set list. I'm going to play this song and that song and this song in that order. That, to me, is, you know, all power to the people who do that. But to me, that's against my energy flow. I can't do a set list.
Do you have any live gigs in Florida in the next month or two? Are you playing anywhere?
Over the last year, I did a couple of little concert tours. I played in some yoga studios and some kirtan festivals. But nice. I don't have anything lined up.
Yet.
You know, if I was more organized, I could do more tours and stuff and, you know, maybe make more of an impression on the world or, you know, even be better a businessman or, you know, selling CDs and whatnot. But I'm just really, really spaced out due to my lifelong meditative nature and also a brain injury I got at age 2, which helps me a lot in my meditation, but it doesn't help me a lot be organized with my interface with the real world.
But that's so what's added
a lot
to
of more
beauty.
Potential is there. I'm kind of like walking wasted potential.
Well, I would say with 108 albums, that's a pretty amazing feat right there. There's not many artists who had that many albums.
Well, most are out of print. I just make small batches by hand. And now, with the help of Elove and her wonderful man, Anthony, I've got one actual mass-produced commercial CD with shrink-wrapped and barcode.
Oh, that's great.
So
how do we get those? Can we get one of those? Is that available online or something?
No, there's nothing online yet. I just have a little shoebox that I just keep in my van, and when I go here and there to, you know, drum circles or craft shows or occasional concert gigs or live yoga music, I'll just set out a little CD display. I usually have 5 to 10 titles in stock, you know, like 5 copies each that I made by hand. So I hope to get everything online the way real musicians are organized and stuff, but I'm just like really, really spaced out.
So you were talking a little bit earlier about secrets, and you spoke while we were off the phone about Tulsi.
Yes, Tulsi, the sacred basil.
Yes,
here's another illustration
secret.
Of the Gudu principle. Once, since I did a lot of networking with various ashrams from 1975 on, at some point somebody asked me if I knew about how to take care of Tulsi plants. You know, your listeners might know about the holy basil. She's in the herb stores and stuff. You could have Tulsi tea, Tulsi tinctures. So anyway, one ashram had a small greenhouse with the Tulsi plants there. And they didn't have anybody to take care of them. They said that the Tulsis were really suffering. They were really, really not doing so well. Would I go there? This was an ashram in Houston. I'd been to many ashrams all the way from New York to L.A. So they sent me to Houston on this wild goose chase because I really didn't know much about plants then. But because I was asked, you know, I'm a very adventuresome person, so when somebody presents something, I think immediately, okay, let's go for it. Let's see what we can do. So I got to Houston, and there was this little Tulsi greenhouse about maybe 8 feet wide and maybe 12 feet long, 15 feet long. And so the Tulsis, they were not doing very good at all. Because in America, she's a tropical plant, you know. So in America, you have to do all this fuss. You have to keep stable temperature, and there's certain bugs that get on her and stuff. So I got there not really knowing much about what I was doing. I just started looking and seeing. Well, here's a bunch of dead leaves in the, you know, in the pot around around the base of the tree. So let me just clean these up. And, oh, here's a few little webs, maybe some spiders or something. So let me just clean this off. So to my great surprise, and this is the guru principle in working again, doesn't just work with people. I noticed that without knowing all of the, there's whole books written about how to care for Tulsi in the West. There's books. You can find them online. But I didn't have any of that. I found that she started getting better just because someone was caring about her. Somebody was in her physical presence and caring without knowing anything. Just caring about the plant, they started getting better.
Right.
So here's the guru principle again.
Is it called Tulsi, T-O-L?
T-U-L-S-I, Tulsi, or the full spelling is T-U-L-A-S-I. You could look up her horticultural name is Holy Basil. And the reason she's called Holy Basil, she comes from the town of Vrindavan in India, and she's purportedly Krishna's favorite plant, Krishna the cosmic flute player.
Wow.
So she's very hard to take care of in the West, and the people who do care for her at different ashrams, they've got these books and special equipment and special spritzer sprayers with certain formulas to keep certain bugs off. But me, not knowing any of the proper care, that this is my punchline, is that she got better just because I was hanging around with her.
Mm.
And, oh, I would sleep with her, too. There was, like, some benches there. So, yeah, I would just roll out a little sleeping bag on the bench, and I would actually sleep with her. So I, like, became her companion. And they all started getting better and started growing huge leaves. Bigger than I'd ever seen before.
Did you play music?
Yeah. I found some old guitar in the ashram junk closet. So I would play my guitar out there with my healing music. And so I guess a combination of healing music plus just caring, doing the guru with the plants. And they got amazingly better. Huge leaves. Big, bright green leaves. When she was like almost dead when I got there.
Wow.
So that was another healing experience with the guru principle, working not just on people but on plants. So I guess it also works for pets. I feed these stray cats here in my neighborhood, and they start out like hating people. They're like, you know, they stay 20 feet away. They say, "We hate you people, but if you put food in a bowl, we'll appreciate it." So I work with them, and I work with them, and now they're all, you know, they all come up to me and rub my legs, and they all want to be petted. So the guru works on cats, and I'm sure it works on dogs, too. Actually, I volunteer when I'm at my other house up in North Georgia Mountains. I volunteer at a no-kill pet shelter, and they introduce me to the other volunteers. Here's Das. He's our cat guru.
He's the cat whisperer.
Because I could take a cat that hates people, and before 3 months is up, she's sitting in your lap purring.
And Das is playing flute with the cat. Well, you also make flutes, so that's a whole nother process.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing, is I'm expanding the healing music around the world by marketing my meditation flutes on my YouTube channel called Fantasy Flutes. And all of my customers that show up, they're really cool people. Everyone's into some kind of meditation, or they do yoga, or they chant Sanskrit mantras. So I tell them directly, if we talk on the phone or by the email, I tell them, you know, I'm not a flute salesman. This is not a sales department. This is a flute adoption agency. You're adopting it so that you can bring healing vibrations to your country. I tell them that there's a pool of good vibrations that circle the planet. And when we play peaceful music, especially on a bamboo flute, like has been done for thousands of years, we add positive vibes into that pool. That pool of positive vibes always increases and nothing can decrease it. Whereas the pool of negative vibes around the planet that's being supplied by wars and negative thinking and violent video games and, you know, whatever negative stuff humanity is into, that goes into the negative pool. But the negative pool can be diminished, whereas the positive pool can only increase. So I tell all my flute customers right up front that this is just the front. You're not just buying an instrument. You're contributing. You're being part of the solution, adding to the pool of positive vibes. One good example is Serbia. You know, Serbia has one, count them, one New Age gift shop there where they're trying to raise the consciousness of their country people. So they wrote me. It's a very nice couple. The lady wrote me and told me what they're doing. She said, my husband wants to play the flute, and we like what you're doing. So he paid for one flute, and I filled up a whole tube full of flutes and CDs and bird calls. And I just loaded them up. It's like, your country needs this.
Nice.
So they wrote me back, and they said, wow, customers are coming in, and my husband plays the flute, and all this great stuff is happening. And so it felt good to, like, contribute to
that's a blessing.
How war-torn that place has been, but this one couple is trying to raise the consciousness there. So I thought, I'm going to do whatever it takes to support them.
Nice. So let the listeners know again, Das, about your website and your YouTube page.
Well, I have the website, fantasyflutes.com, but it's not really, like, developed and working very much. It's kind of like a placeholder. People get in touch with me individually, and we get them fitted for what type of ancient tuning they like and how big are their hands. If they want to play a bass flute, you know, you have to be, you know, you need to be this tall to ride this ride, this tall to ride this flute. So I get people individually fixed up. They get in touch with me. But they watch my videos on the YouTube channel. I've got about 25 videos, most of them showcasing different models, and other videos are giving away 25 years of flute tuning tricks for free. So people, they just find me on YouTube mostly.
So it's also Fantasy Flutes on YouTube.
Yeah, the Fantasy Flutes channel on YouTube. And if you type my name, Das, D-A-S, and space, and the word bamboo, you know, Das and bamboo or flute, I pretty much pop up in the list. And I try to put some humor in there, too. A lot of people say they just, even if they don't want to buy a flute, they watch all the videos because it's funny. I've got a few. The next few I'm planning are going to be really crazy.
So we have time for one more song, and I have a couple of choices, Drifting Cloud Banks or Deeper Forest. Das, it's your pick. They're both gorgeous.
Deeper Forest Secret Pathway.
Nice.
Or what was the other?
Drifting Cloud Banks, Skimming Treetops.
No, let's do Deeper Forest Secret Pathway.
Okay.
Now this one, this concept behind this one is that if you're walking way out in the woods, sometimes you'll come upon some really magical grove or something that's kind of so shady that it's almost dark, even in the midday. So you're in the deep forest, and then you're in this really, really shady spot, and then if you look around, you see a little path. So you start following this path, and I'm not able to describe what you would find there, but you'll discover it yourself when you hear the song.
Beautiful. So let's give a listen. And this is also from your Forest Music album.
Yes.
Join us every first and third Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Or listen again online at bbsradio.com/energymedicineradio. Wishing you the best in your health, wealth, and happiness.